Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts today are Susan Franson and Gina McAndrews.
Hello, Gina, and welcome to you, the listener. As we watch the sky for clouds and look out the window for rain, or feel it if we're out, I thought it was time to get back to the subject of agriculture. I got a press release last week about an article in the Ag Decision Maker. Here's the summary. According to the report, the bottom third of farms ranked according to annual return to management have consistently averaged negative accrued net farm income levels since 2015, while the top third has consistently averaged incomes more than twice the state average.
Well, that's starting to sound like the farm crisis of the 1980s. We had an interview with Pamela Riney Kerberg, who was writing history of the crisis, but I'd like to hear more about what's happening right now.
I agree, and our first guest has the ideal background to make that comparison. Steve Johnson, farm management specialist with ISU Extension and Outreach, was an ag lender with Brenton Banks in Knoxville, Iowa, from 1983 through 1987. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome. Good to be with you.
Do the current farm financial issues remind you of the 1980s?
Not exactly. The fact is that we've got a lot of farm financial stress, but it's not the same type of financial stress. The 80s was about solvency, whether your assets exceeded your liabilities. This farm stress is about liquidity. Do I have adequate cash to service my existing debt and provide family living, and to be able to replace machinery, equipment, and livestock? So no, one was about solvency, sudden collapse in land values. Land values go down 50% from 1981 to 1986. This one is not like that at all. These land values have only gone down about 16%. So if you have assets and they're paid for, you're probably able to ride this one out. But just like the research study from Dr. Plastina, we've got a lot of farmers that aren't making money. Even last year, when net farm income was up in Iowa, we still have this low third that have poor liquidity and are likely struggling today.
Steve, of those that had a higher income, what portion of that was due from the stimulus and the farm programs money?
Well, the data that we're looking at is 19 data. So the 19 data would include both the market facilitation program payments that were made on crops. So we don't see the stimulus money that we've seen over the last 6 months. That's not going to be included in the 19 income. But I would say that government farm program payments in 19 were a significant player, primarily market facilitation program payments that averaged $67 per tillable acre in the state of Iowa. So if you want to reflect, oh, is that the government money? Yeah, that's probably the average $67 per tillable acre that was made by MFP. Again, 75% of those payments were made in the 2019 calendar year.
What were some of the keys to the financial recovery from the 80s?
Well, I think there were several. Number one, the federal government stepped in late 1985, and we passed the largest farm bill in history. More money with inflated dollars than we had today. It was called the 1985 Farm Bill. It was passed late during the lame duck session in December of 85, and it was implemented in 86. I'm a lender, so I'm front line. And you said, well, what did it do? Well, it created some new programs, CRP. I think you've heard of that one. It created set-aside programs. It included the dairy herd buyout. And it kept these low commodity crop prices off the market. The government came in and created farmer-owned reserves. So as we crashed the land values by 50%, then all of a sudden, farmers had the same issue, is they've got problems with finances, low crop prices, low livestock prices. But the government programs and the Farm Bill of 1985 provided enough mechanisms that we took eventually 39 million tillable acres out of production, the CRP, and we kept the corn, soybeans, wheat off the market. We bought old dairy cows, and a lot of people left dairying during that time frame. So I think the issue was that. But really, what really lifted us out, the global economy improved. So the global economy came out of this deep recession, farm depression, and then eventually we got a drought, and it was the drought of 88. That's really what lifted things as we got higher corn and soybean prices. But I think the similarities are you can't borrow your way out of these farm financial stresses, and you can't store your way out of these farm financial stresses, and especially livestock. They've got to be processed. So I think that's the similarities that I see. How farmers respond, that's the key. That's of interest today.
Why do you think there's such a problem with liquidity? I mean, is it because these farm equipment, I mean, a combine now is $500,000, and loans are harder to get from banks and that sort of thing?
I think you got to step back. I don't think it's necessarily a manufacturer or a seed. These inputs are all higher, but you have to improve your knowledge. I think the biggest limitation is how farmers adapt their risk management skills. I specialize in crop marketing, government farm programs, and crop insurance. A farmer has got to be at the top of their game. If you're going to spend $500,000 for a combine and $12,000 for land, then you better understand how are you going to pay for those particular items. And a lot of that likely involves having equity already in land. So those that are buying farmland today, we can tell from our survey, 75% are existing farmers. Well, how can farmers buy farmland? I thought they were all broke. No, that research by Dr. Plastina is saying this top third is making twice as much as the average farm. And this low third quality, they're losing money. And I think that's exactly what's going on. It's like last night's rain. If you were in parts of Story County, you got a flooded basement. If you're in parts of Boone County, you got 0.2 inches of rain. The farm financial issues are a lot like last night's rain. Some got it and some don't.
And how do you think competition gets into the marketing, like with livestock, with the vertical integration of fewer markets, fewer sale barns, fewer packers to sell your livestock to? I mean, there's not as much livestock or competition with the packers feeding their own livestock these days.
No, absolutely. Yet we have more livestock today than any time in history. So certain segments of producers said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and build a confinement building, but I am going to align myself with an integrator. I own the building. I take care of the hogs, but I might not own the hogs. So that's a part of that adaptation that I think we've seen. It's this independent, roughly 10% in some sectors of livestock that are still doing what they were doing 30 years ago, is just selling those hogs, selling those cattle where I can get the best price. So I believe that vertical integration is a part of the response for the need for low food prices. And again, you got a glimpse of that in the 80s as we started to build confinement buildings for hogs. And you had to make that decision. Am I going to be a part of this integrated system, or am I going to remain an independent? And so there's risk on both sides, but agriculture is a capital-intensive business. It's a high-volume low margin business. And that's where you have to adapt to the environment. Wayne Gretzky said, I'm not the best player of hockey. I go where the puck is going.
And so do you think it's going to keep increasing into more vertical integration and just big corporations controlling most of the livestock and the processing all the way to the grocery store? Or do you think there's going to be more openings for local markets, local processors, local people buying more local?
I think there'll be both. I think we live in a time where we want cheap food and we want access to that food. So I think there will always be some sort of a integrated system so that we can process large volumes of livestock and eggs and milk in short periods of time. But I think there's a place for that small producer. They've got to be an excellent marketer and an excellent manager. They've got to be able to understand the market, not just the ability to produce a product. And so I think that you will see those small, independent operations, especially livestock and maybe some forms of non-specialty crops, but they're going to have to adapt. They're going to have to be very good at getting that product to market in a timely fashion. So I think there's places for both the commodity as well as the non-commodity production. But no, I think the integrated systems that we can keep our overall food prices low, I think we're going to continue to see that system exist. And you as a producer are going to have to decide, am I going to participate in that integrated system where I've got to understand contracts? I might have to use futures and options to manage that commodity business. Or am I just going to understand what are people willing to pay for this particular product that I take to the farmer's market or that I deliver via community-supported agriculture? There will be a place for both.
What do you think as far as the farm bill in the near future that will, you know, help as far as policy?
Well, we just got a farm bill. It was the 2018 farm bill. It's being implemented now over the next 5 years, the 19 through the 23 crop. There was money there to do different types of research and activities, community-supported agriculture, veterans, beginning farmers. And, you know, I know there's talk, well, we've got to write a farm bill again. You know, well, I don't think you can get that Congress to agree of what day to celebrate Mother's Day. So I doubt we're going to get a new farm bill. I think that you're going to see USDA try to move into different types of directions with how the 18 farm bill was written. But no, I don't think the answer is just the federal government. That's why I chose to leave lending in the 80s. The answer isn't the federal government. The answer is us. How do we adapt? You know, I always say, give a farmer the rules and regulations and they will understand it. And that's where agriculture is at today, is you've got to be very adept at understanding what the rules and the regulations are. And I don't think it's going to be, you know, the federal government that comes running in here like 1985. We're going to have a federal government spending a lot of money. There's no doubt about it. CFAP, you know, doesn't matter really what you produce, whether it's an egg or an emu, is there was a coronavirus food protection program that was available to you. I think you're going to see the government help on the periphery, but the government can't help you with the management decisions and the record keeping and the marketing and the understanding, the insurance, working with the landowner. Those are skills that I think the existing producer have got to improve upon.
Do you think they should go back to enforcing the packers and stockyards regulations?
I'm not an expert. I know that's in the media. I know that that's, you know, where our existing Congress and representatives are at. But no, I'm a specialist on crop marketing, government farm programs, and crop insurance. I'm a mile deep and an inch wide. So I don't do a lot of work with livestock. Even though I got my PhD at Colorado State, I specialize in row crop agriculture and farm financial issues.
What do you think some of the best ways for young farmers to produce other crops besides the commodity, corn and soybeans?
Start small. Understand the market. Don't try to replicate, you know, that particular direct market item. like it's a commodity business, because that product probably can't be taken to the local elevator or co-op. It can't be taken to the processor. So I think that you've got to understand your market very well. And to the point that if you're going to grow that, now you've got to understand is that, am I going to just deliver to the Des Moines farmers market, the Ames farmers market? If so, then I'm probably going to have to make sure that this is very small scale. And how about working with your landowner? I think the bigger issue in agriculture today is the majority of land is owned by an older Iowan. And the fact is that the majority of our land is rented. And so not trying to buy that land as a part of your risk management strategy is being able to work with the landowner, the landlord, and on a longer-term lease and not the year-to-year lease that most of our row crops are on. Those take different management skills, probably a lot more relationship management skills. So I see that direct market farmer having to adapt to a different environment. They're probably not dependent upon the federal government and a program and a payment. They're probably dependent upon their own skills to, again, produce a product that they can deliver in a timely fashion to a marketplace that they're receiving direct payment from.
So you don't see the Farm Bill expanding into other crops, per se?
The Farm Bill is fairly set. When you write the Farm Bill, again, Congress writes it, the House and Senate pass it, the President signs it, and it's got a framework around it. I think what you're talking about, can the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, look at taking parts of the existing Farm Bill and allocate those funds other places? We just did that with the CFAP, Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. I mean, you've got vegetable growers and specialty livestock that are receiving payments. By the way, the deadline is August 28th, that I've never seen. I've never seen those particular groups receive payments before. That's why it was such a big deal of working with your FSA office. And, you know, I heard from some people that said, well, I've got one steer. Do I qualify? Yes. Well, is it worth my time to get $37? Probably not. So, you know, is that a hurdle? Well, you decide. But if you're looking for somebody to come running in on a white horse to help farmers, I think it's probably going to be USDA, at least over the next 4 years, of how can we create a little different vision. But those were specialty funds. Remember, USDA was allocating mostly the CARES Act, $3.2 trillion. And now we're hearing there's possibly another $1 trillion act that might be passed by the Senate and the House. Well, I just don't think there's going to be a lot of money in that to help, you know, this specialty crop producer. So I think that specialty crop producer is going to have to be really good at understanding their market and their risk and not thinking that we're going to create some sort of a magic farm bill that's going to solve these problems. And I don't think there's near the money that's available in this period of time, where we've already taken on roughly $23 trillion in debt the U.S. has now.
What impact do you think China's had on a lot of our local farmers being in challenging situations?
I think the biggest difference, if we'd have had this radio interview in January, I don't think we would have been talking about coronavirus or COVID-19 or CFAP or some of the farm financial stress. I think that it's not just the trade issues that had played out over the last 20 years. Now we've got this coronavirus that is, and I'm not totally blaming China, but we know that's where it originated. But the fact is that we live in different times. This is like no other time I've ever lived, where we've got a virus, people aren't leaving their home, people are shopping online and having groceries delivered. Think of how that affects that direct market producer that's, you know, got a garden that's, you know, 18 acres, but now they've got to rethink of how they're distributing their food product. I think the coronavirus is the black swan event that no one could have anticipated that makes it even tougher in this environment to be able to find adequate cash flow. And again, the original question about liquidity, where am I going to find cash flow needs for this summer and this fall? So I think we'll likely see some farm businesses exiting by fall and winter. It's just going to be that big of a struggle, just like local retail stores, restaurants, and bars. They're not going to be in business. They're going to be more signs on the window closed. I think we're going to see that in some of these farming operations. And I'm not saying that, well, we got to have somebody to blame. It was just the impact of the coronavirus that I personally think we'll be feeling in 2, 3, 4 years from now. We'll still have that impact. And the fact is that we disrupted, you know, the supply chain, and we changed what the retail market might provide for especially crop or livestock producer.
And what are some of the main strategies producers use to manage risk? Pretty much just contract marketing and...
Well, I think you got to step back. I mean, you know, the marketing is important, no doubt about that. But I think they keep good records. You know, I work with some very successful farmers across the Midwest, and you know, they're all very business oriented. They keep meticulous records. They know their farm finances. They know what they do. They're very good at what they do, and they start there. They start with things they can control, and they're not controlled by their lender. They're not controlled by their merchandiser, their local processor. I think that that's where you start. And again, I think there's a special pride of being an independent producer, but you've got to be very adept at change. And I think over the last 10 years, I think that's what I've witnessed. I'm watching some producers that can adapt to the times. And, you know, not complain, you know, they didn't get rain yesterday, you know, so I'm cursing, you know, you wake up in the morning and some say, good God morning. And some say, good morning, God. I think that is the difference. I think your attitude and your ability to adapt and change, I think that's really the key right now. So yeah, you got to understand your markets and a market contract. You got to understand the futures and the cash price. You got to understand crop insurance. You got to understand the ARC PLC program. So there's more to understand today, and that's true of the commodity markets. I think it'd even be larger for the direct market producer. They've got to be very good at what they do, and before you get bigger, you get better.
Is there roles landlords can play to assist producers as far as requirements on their property or?
Absolutely. Again, a landlord, okay. Landlords own the farmland. Roughly in the state of Iowa, around 44% of those are operating the land that they own. But the majority of that land, they are renting that land to somebody else that's operating it. And I think that communication and that trust with the landlords is key, is the fact that there's good communications. There's an exchange of information. Today is July 15th. Today is the deadline for certifying your planted acres with your local USDA Farm Service Agency office. And so I think if I'm a producer, I'm going to give a copy of that to my landlord so they know how many acres I planted and I certified. I'm going to give a copy to my crop insurance agent because my crop insurance is going to reflect how many acres I planted. I got hail last night. I've got to be able to acknowledge how many acres did I have of corn and soybeans on that particular farm. So something as simple as a certified planted acreage, I encourage landowners, and I work with a lot of landowners. I think having open lines of communication and building trust, and that is that reflection on stewardship practices. How are you farming my land? What's the fertility levels? What type of seed? What type of crop protection are you using? So yeah, I think that's another area that is very weak in Iowa. I say that after 21 years at Iowa State University, the knowledge of the landowners, especially those that were never the active producers, has not improved significantly over 21 years. And I challenged the landowners. You know, I had a great conversation with a landowner in Tennessee, and their land is in Marshall County, Iowa. And I won't give much more information, but the fact is that she inherited the land and that she has control of the land, but she doesn't know very much about the land. She doesn't know the yields. She doesn't know the corn suitability rating 2, even though she's been paying property taxes on the CSR 2 for the last 5 years. She just assumes that the tenant can grow 200 bushel corn, so they must be making money. Well, I just did a video yesterday, and I'll be honest with you. You can grow 200 bushel corn in central Iowa, and you can lose money in a year like this, especially if you don't have your corn marketed, and we get 3 inches of rain in the middle of July. So there's the perfect example, is that I believe that we've got landowners that we've got to improve their knowledge. And I mentioned she's in Tennessee. She's not going to come to an in-person meeting. She wanted the video that I recorded yesterday and the 100-page farmland leasing book. But it's up to her to have that dialogue with her tenant operator that's been on that farm for 40 years. So, yeah, I don't want to ruffle the feathers of the relationships, but we've got to improve the knowledge and understanding and communication of not only the producer and the tenant operators, but those landowners, because they're key as far as where we're going longer term in Iowa, is because that land eventually will not be in the same hands, because we're going to have older landowners and some of that land will be transferred to the next generation, but much of this land will be sold or auctioned to the highest bidder.
Well, thank you. That is a pretty dramatic ending to. I'm looking at our clock, and we're going to have to invite you back, Steve.
Sounds good. Again, farmland leasing meetings in person in central Iowa. They'll start on August 3rd, so make sure you contact your local county extension office. You'd like to attend an in-person farmland leasing meetings, or we'll have videos, we'll have a 100-page book, we'll do webinars, and we will do a la carte. How would you like information on farmland leasing?
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. God bless. Stay safe.
Well, thank you. In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts for today are Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, and we've been talking with Steve Johnson, Farm Management Specialist with ISU Extension, comparing the problems of that farmers are facing today with those of the farm crisis of the 80s. For a little more perspective, I'd like to play an interview with Pamela Reine-Kerberg from the ISU History Department, talking about a book she's writing on the farm crisis of the 80s. So let's listen in.
It seems to me that I hear farm crisis stories from almost everybody who has been living through that period. I even heard one at the presidential forum that was down at the Iowa Farmers Union. Tom Delaney talked about his father-in-law, who was a potato farmer in Idaho and lost the farm because the bank failed.
The emphasis is very much on farmers as men and farmers as adults. And we often forget that farming was very much in that era a family business. I mean, it's still a family business today, but in the 1980s, very much a family business. And if something was going to go wrong on the farm, it also went wrong in the lives of farm women and farm children. And I don't want to leave them out of the equation, because what happened with farms in the 1980s has a dramatic effect on us now. Farmers in Iowa are far older on average than they were in the 1980s. And it's because a whole generation of young people decided, based on their horrible experience of those years, that this was something that they didn't want to do. And many parents also decided that this was something they didn't want for their children and discouraged their children from going into farming. And so I was interviewing someone in Extension, and he used a term I'd never heard before. And that term was last generation farmer. There are lots and lots of farmers in Iowa who are last generation farmers. There's no one in their family who wants to take over the business of farming the land when they retire. And so it's the last generation that farm will be in their family, worked by their family.
That sounds like a tragedy.
It sort of depends on what direction you look at the issue. For some of those farmers, I'm sure it does feel like a tragedy that the working of the farm is going to pass out of their hands. Others of these farmers completely understand and accept that their children want to do something that's less risky, less fraught with stress and anxiety. You know, the farm economy is not in very good shape right now, and they can understand why their kids don't want to do this.
I believe that your presentation, it may not be the same presentation you're going to do in Boone, but you have had this paired with someone talking about farming today. I guess you've given a number of these together, and you said just one left. Is that right?
Well, yes. There's been a whole series this fall of lectures called Earth's Bounty in Iowa Then and Now, and we did four presentations around the state in Sioux Center, in Washington, in Waverly, and in Nevada.
I guess mostly it is about the results in the lives of the young people who went through that.
Well, some of it will be about the young people. What I'll talk about on Saturday are the causes. I'll look a bit at the 1970s and talk about the causes, talk about what happened. And then I decided to look at the crisis from several different angles. I'm going to be looking at mental health. I'm going to be looking at the food crisis that accompanied the farm crisis because of the use of food stamps soared in Iowa during the farm crisis. I'm going to look at farm youth, and then I'll wrap up by talking about some of its implications for Boone and other rural communities in the state.
How do you do your research? Do you gather a lot of stories?
Well, I gather stories. I gather records. One of the most fascinating parts of this whole research process has been going through Governor Branstad's papers, which have just been opened for research. They are not processed. They're not organized. It's kind of a mess. But buried in those 1,300 boxes of records are thousands of letters from Iowans about their experiences. And so I've been drawing very heavily on those letters to see what people were feeling, what they were thinking, what they wanted to come out of the situation. And these letters came from men, they came from women, they came from children. It's an amazing archive of average Iowans sitting down, sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning, to write their governor and explain their position and what they needed.
What was the governor's response?
Very, very sympathetic. One of the things that really echoes in all of these letters was Branstad's own background in agriculture and having grown up on a farm. And he felt really deep sympathy for the troubles that people were facing. And one of the things that I've really found interesting about the letters is that he never blamed people for the situation that they were in. Sometimes their neighbors blamed them. Sometimes their friends blamed them. Sometimes their own family blamed them. But the governor's office never took that approach. And sometimes there wasn't a whole lot he could do, but he never, ever blamed them for the situation they were in.
Were there any policies that could have made a difference?
Well, yes. The main policy that would have made the most difference would have been if in 1979, Paul Volcker, who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, had not decided to wring the inflation out of the economy by raising interest rates to astronomical levels. The interest rates in 79, 80, 81 went as high as 24%, which meant that farmers took the brunt of getting, farmers and anybody who had debt took the brunt of getting the inflation out of the economy. They weren't thinking about who this might affect. And once the policy started working, they didn't care who it affected. And so lots of families ended up with debt burdens that they could not possibly support.
This was the debt that's almost routine, borrow money to plant, and they had these 24%.
Mm-hmm. The farmers went into the late 70s, early 1980s with a couple of different kinds of debt. A lot of them had expanded in the 1970s. A lot of them had made improvements on their farms. A lot of them bought land, and it was a bad time to buy land because land prices went through the roof in the 1970s. And so they had that kind of debt, which became a very bad thing when interest rates went up. But then they also had operating expenses. And by the time it got to be 1980, 81, 82, somewhere around a third of Iowa's farmers were in imminent danger of losing their farms.
I've heard that there are a lot of farmers today who are in a similar situation. Are the causes different?
Actually, a lot of the problems are very similar. Farmers today still are getting fairly low prices for their corn and their soybeans. The prices they pay for technology and for all of their operating expenses are high. And now they have to contend with a trade war, which was, again, something completely out of their control, a decision made in Washington without a whole lot of thought being put toward who it might damage. You know, farmers are less than 2% of the population. And when you're less than 2% of the population, people in Washington don't always think terribly carefully about how their policies might affect that 2%.
And the worrisome years over the hill, I thought it's supposed to get easier to pay your bills. I got nothing to show except a worrisome heart. Can you please tell me, when does the good part start? I done like they told me, I done like I should. Ever since I started, I was trying to make good, trying to make a good life for my family. But I can't buy any of that stuff the kids want from TV. And the worrisome years over the hill, I thought it's supposed to get easier to pay your bills. I got nothing to show except a worrisome heart. Well, can you please tell me, when does the good part start? Think about leaving, but where would I go? How would I get there? I don't know. I took my stand here, I don't want to roam. This old town ain't much, but it's all I know. Home in the worrisome years over the hill, I thought it's supposed to get easier to pay your bills. I got nothing to show except a worrisome heart. Well, can you please tell me, when does the good part start?
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Greg Brown singing The Worrisome Years, which was a fitting end to the comparison of the farm crisis of the 1980s and the present problems facing farmers in 2020.
For those of you who would like to plan boldly for a brighter future, we have Ava Owen Ryan from Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. telling us about a series of virtual community meetings. When I received an email with this description, I thought it would be something interesting to bring to our listeners. Political and social change is sweeping the country. Now is our chance to create the future we need. This month, join us for the Seeds of Change webinar nearest you.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me. Yeah, you're exactly right. We're seeing political and social change sweeping across the country, people taking to the streets and demanding the bold solutions that we need to create a better Iowa and to create a better world for lots and lots more people. So whether we're talking about our agricultural system like you all are today, that's currently corporate controlled and designed to exploit people, communities, and our environment, all to maximize profits, we know that we need to a decisively new world, one that's rooted in community care and one that puts people and our planet, our water, our natural resources before the profits, politics, and polluters. This is really applicable no matter what issue you're talking about. So at these meetings, you know, we will be talking about our food system, how we get clean water and slow and stop the expansion of the factory farm industry. But we'll also be talking about our healthcare system. We'll also be talking about racial justice, climate justice, and how our government should work for us, not for big money corporations. So, and history tells us that change can be born out of crisis moments. And I know that we're all facing moments that a lot of us have never seen before in our life with the pandemic. And so we know that out of these crises, we can create the change that we need. And so these meetings are really just an opportunity. They're going to be led by CCI issue organizers, but also by CCI member leaders from across the state. And it's going to be an opportunity to connect and be in conversation with fellow CCI members, also with Iowans who share your values. It's going to be an opportunity to hear updates and plug in on next steps we're taking for clean water, a factory farm moratorium, also COVID protections, racial justice, and healthcare for all. And it's also going to be an opportunity for us to strategize about how we impact the November elections to really set us up to create and win some of the changes that we need to see here in Iowa. So that's basically what we're planning on doing. And if folks are interested in joining, the best way is to go to www.cciaction.org/seeds of change. And if folks visit there, they'll be able to see all of the meetings. They're going to be every Wednesday for the rest of this month at 6 p.m. And people will see a variety of meetings that they can choose from and pick the one that works best for them.
Well, thank you,
Ava.
Yeah, thank you all.
And that was Ava Owen Bryan from Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, introducing the virtual community meetings that will begin tonight. On our website, we'll have the link that will take you to all of them. But if you can't get to our link, another way to find them, besides the link address that Ava gave you, is to Google CCI Seeds of Change or Seeds of Change Virtual Community Meetings.
Well, to wrap up our show, we have Dennis Hart and Paul Wearson talking about a story that never would have made the papers probably before COVID-19, the conditions of workers in the meatpacking plants. Hello, welcome, Dennis and Paul.
Good morning, everybody. How are you doing, Paul?
I am here on the farm. There's some gentle rain falling outside and nice, cool, nice, refreshing air coming in the window. Lovely
day.
We had
a little refreshing air coming in last night with that storm. In fact, we spent time in the basement when the tornado warning sirens went off here in Ames. Did you have them up there?
No. It's 10 miles can sometimes make a vast difference in rain
and
storms.
We had a wild one here last night in Ames. Well, Paul, you and I have been talking about the meatpacking industry, and I think the coronavirus really showed the strength and the weakness of the industry as it exists in the United States right now, the strength being that a few major companies control the vast majority of meat and poultry processing and can provide a smooth flow of meat and poultry to supermarkets, to restaurants, at a relatively inexpensive price for the consumers. The weakness that we saw is that the one interruption, the coronavirus, literally disrupted the entire industry and the economy of the United States. When those workers began getting sick in the packing plants, and when the plants had to shut down, literally meat shortages showed up, particularly on the West Coast, where we lost complete sections of meat in our supermarkets when the price of meat skyrocketed. And of course, restaurants shutting down cut off that particular portion of the market for the meat packers, and they were not prepared to change the way they packed the meat to accommodate that. We really were exposed there, weren't we, by the coronavirus in terms of the meatpacking industry as it exists in the U.S.
Yeah, every industry was affected because right now we have this highly efficient system. Amazon is another example. Every supplier, whether it's agriculture and meat products or any other thing you can name, it's just-in-time delivery. We have this great digital system where things happen so quickly that nobody keeps much inventory on hand. So as if there's a disruption, the effect on the marketplace is instantaneous. And of course, all the people who package meat for stores and restaurants weren't able to switch over to package that in ways saleable at the retail point in grocery stores. And of course, the virus also taught us how vulnerable the most vulnerable among us are, which really assigns to the condition of the folks who work in these plants, because that's where we had the outbreak, and that's where they had to shut down that created this supply chain crisis. So it really highlighted the working conditions in the packing plants and the real vulnerability of these people, not only in terms of the danger of the workplace, but also their susceptibility to the virus that they bring home and then spread to family members. And of course, a lot of these families are multi-generational, living in one home. So it's really a petri dish of spreading the illness. You know?
Absolutely. Right. Human Rights Watch has called the meatpacking industry, as you know, the most dangerous factory job in America. And in this particular pandemic, through the month of only May, we haven't gotten June's figures, out of the 585,000 people who work in the meatpacking industry, more than 17,000 of those workers were infected with the coronavirus. 91 of them died. And it also showed, this particular virus, the inequity of, as you have pointed out, how it spread. 87% of those infected in the meatpacking industry were minority people, ethnic minorities, compared to 61%, it's 61%, who work in the industry. In other words, it was a disproportionate impact on ethnic minorities who work in the meatpacking industry.
That's right. You know, historically, we, and Dennis, you furnished me a wonderful rundown of the meatpacking history in America. And of course, the famous novel by Sinclair Lewis about the jungle that highlighted all the working conditions in the slaughterhouses in America back in 1906. And, you know, it talked about the rail system and how that facilitated distribution of meat and the whole revolution of refrigerated cars so they could ship beef instead of live animals, animals that had already been butchered. And so it's been a real efficient industry, but a very hazardous industry. And historically, the people who are recently arrived in the country are the ones who take the jobs Americans don't want to do. And a great example is the building of the Transcontinental Railway, authorized by Abraham Lincoln. You know, in 1869, I think they drove the Golden Spike. Well, that was built by Chinese and Irishmen, who were people who were not very valued. You know, you had thousands of Irish people come during the potato famine in the 19th century. And these were people who were looked on with suspicion and like they were interrupting and taking jobs. But in reality, they too were doing jobs that Americans wouldn't do. Who wanted to build the Continental Railway, you know? You had to work in labor camps and live in terrible conditions and be gone from your family for months out in the particularly desert Southwest in terrible conditions. And so Americans didn't want those jobs, so immigrants did them. Well, nothing really changes. That's what's happening in America right now. The recently arrived immigrants take these jobs that are not desirable, and they were hit disproportionately by the COVID-19 virus, and they're also the people who are most likely to be injured or killed on the job.
You are correct. And of course, as you mentioned, the Food and Drug Act, which came about as a result of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, tried to clean up things in the meatpacking industry, but it is still by necessity a dirty, not dirty, but a messy job. You are there in the meatpacking plants on the kill floor, killing animals. You are working in blood. You are cutting up meat. It is by necessity, the way we have it set up, a dangerous occupation, and workers side by side, that leads to the potential, as we saw in the coronavirus, to sickness overwhelming those workers almost instantaneously.
Right. And of course, when I grew up here on the farm, and I had my career at Des Moines, but of course, I'm living on the farm I grew up on. I remember marketing cattle and hogs in a different way. The smaller packers, we sent a lot of our stock up to the local locker up here. And actually, in Story City now, we have a locker again. Highly efficient one, a very aggressive businessman who processes everything from farm animals to deer and all that sort of thing. He's really quite an enterprising guy. But I remember in the 50s, we hauled things uptown or to... There were so many different outlets, you know. You had Rath Packing and Swift Packing. A lot of different companies. And so farmers had options to take their cattle to more than one point. Now, you're pretty much obligated to go to one plant. And if that plant went down, then all the farmers who feed into it had to keep their stock beyond marketing weight. And some of them had to be euthanized, you know. So
right.
This is just a just-in-time supply chain that got disrupted very badly.
And one of the problems with having such few industry leaders running the industry in beef packing is JBS and Tyson, of course, and in pork, it's Smithfield and Tyson and JBS. But they are so big now, employing thousands of workers at the plants, that when the virus broke out, Governor Reynolds in particular did not shut down those meat packing plants because of the potential dramatic disruption to the state's economy. Well, by keeping them open, of course, you then continued to expose the workers to the virus. They would then take it out to their families, potentially, into the communities where they worked, into Marshalltown, into Perry, et cetera. And so you had the catch-22. If she shut down the meatpacking plants, you disrupted the economy. If you don't, then you spread the virus out into the community. It was a no-win.
That's definitely true in all sectors of the economy. Economic pressures versus safety.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen. Other voices you heard were Steve Johnson, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, Ava Owen Ryan, Dennis Hart, and Paul Wearson.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, the Ames Public Library will present Reading Radio Live. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Worrisome Years by Greg Brown from the album If I Had Known, Essential Recordings, 1980 to 1996.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. just hit the yellow Donate, Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.